Hi, it's Diane. Great to be back with you after our August break. On my mind this week, the confirmation hearings of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Partisan rancor was on full display in the Senate. Meanwhile, Washington was gripped by further revelations of dysfunction in the White House. To help us make sense of all this, first I talked with constitutional law professor Garrett Epps.
The entire spectacle has been one of the most surreal things that Washington has seen, certainly in my lifetime.
He gives us his take on the Senate confirmation hearings, fights over documents, and what a Brett Kavanaugh appointment would mean for the court. Then I talk to the person I always want to hear from when things get complicated, longtime political analyst Norm Ornstein.
It's one thing to simply accept the fact that he's enriching himself while president. It's another if he's ready to abrogate treaties, go to war, or do things that could endanger the very fabric of this society.
But first, here is Garrett Epps, constitutional law professor at the University of Baltimore and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Garrett Epps, last July, you wrote in The Atlantic that Brett Kavanaugh is, quote, devoted to the presidency. What did you mean, and what did you see this week?
Well, going back to last July, the moment the nomination was announced, you could see from his resume, we've never had, judicial candidate, a Supreme Court justice candidate, whose career has been more completely involved with executive power and particularly the White House. Kavanaugh is entirely a product of the District of Columbia, born here in D.C., went to Georgetown Prep, has done virtually his entire legal career here, most of it either in service to the executive branch or as an attorney with Ken Starr involved in kind of investigating and prosecuting a Democratic president. So executive questions are very much on his mind. Now, what did we see this week about that? Well, I thought in some ways the most powerful testimony that Kavanaugh gave was talking about what it was like to work in the White House on the day of September 11th and in the days after September 11th. And he said several times that George Bush came into the office immediately after the attack and said, this will never happen again. He said President Bush came in every morning and said, this must never happen again. He was obviously transfixed by the spectacle of the executive branch mobilizing all its resources in an attempt to defend what it saw as national security. And I think that has profoundly deepened his allegiance, and I use that word consciously, to the executive branch as the most important and powerful branch of government.
But does that take away from his belief in the judiciary and the power of the judiciary?
I have not seen overwhelming evidence that he is really a fan of judicial power. He is certainly, in the years since going to work for President Bush, he has talked a good deal about how possibly some of the precedents that hold presidents to account are wrongly decided, and that we need to provide presidents perhaps with complete immunity from criminal investigation while they're in office. That's a pretty radical position. You know, I haven't heard many people enunciate that.
Any other judges share that view?
Well, I'm sure there are, because deference to executive power is a very important part of, you know, what would be called movement conservatism or the conservative legal movement since the 1980s. And the idea of the unitary executive, the idea that the president has complete authority over the executive branch and thus, for example, could not be prevented from firing the special counsel even by congressional legislation. That's a fairly standard executive conservative idea. But Kavanaugh embodies it in a very strong form.
I must say, I personally have been riveted to those hearings. Have there been moments that you thought were particularly revealing about Judge Kavanaugh?
The entire spectacle has been one of the most surreal things that Washington has seen, you know, certainly in my lifetime. The backdrop of this presidential meltdown that's been going on, the absolute hijacking of the proceedings for partisan reasons. But beyond that, you know, I think it's useful to draw a contrast between Kavanaugh as a candidate and then Judge, now Justice Gorsuch, as a candidate. Gorsuch was at pains to try to project a kind of friendly and likable persona. You know, he reminds me a little bit of Tony Bennett, you know, with the big smile and hi, how are you? Kavanaugh's got none of that. He's really kind of deadpan. He doesn't give much away. His sense of humor is not non-existent, but it's pretty much limited. He doesn't have a lot of personal touch. And there are two moments linked together that I think are quite memorable to me. That is that at one point during the first day, Fred Gutenberg, who is present as a guest of the committee, the father of one of the Parkland shooting victims, attempted to introduce himself to Judge Kavanaugh. And Kavanaugh turned and walked away. Now, it's not clear whether that was at the instructions of security or not. We can't tell. Gutenberg says he felt that he was being snubbed. But what was striking to me about that was, you know, that could be. Let's give Kavanaugh the benefit of the doubt. He was asked the next day by Senator Lindsey Graham, is there anything you would like to say, you know, to the parents of Parkland survivors or anyone else? It was a perfect opportunity to do a gracious, you know, I'm very sorry for the confusion.
Sure.
I know you disagree with
sure.
me, but I'm a parent too. There was none of that. He instead immediately began to talk about himself, all his good works, how he tries to be a good person. He feeds the homeless. He coaches youth basketball.
And there is no question. He is really involved.
Yes. But it just showed such a kind of distant, kind of impersonal affect that I was very surprised. And in fact, I had thought when Graham asked him that question, I thought, how clever of them to set it up.
Opening.
This must have
yeah.
been a setup. This
right.
you know, he must have been briefed. Do this.
Right.
He didn't do it. And that was kind of stunning to me. And it exemplifies the kind of impersonality of the affect that we're seeing on our screens.
And the second moment that drew you.
Well, those are those two, you know. The other moments that have been very striking involving Kavanaugh are the ones where particularly where he tried to discuss his opinion in Hargan versus Garza, which is the case involving the young woman being held in immigration detention who had fulfilled all the legal requirements for an abortion, but was still being blocked by the administration on the grounds that they would prefer that she not have an abortion. That's literally the terms that were being used. And the D.C. Circuit in-bank panel said, look, this woman, she may be an undocumented alien, but she has the same rights under the Due Process Clause as any other person in the United States, and she has fulfilled the legal requirements for an abortion. She is entitled to make that choice. And instead of stalling, because, of course, days were going by and she was going to reach the legal limit for when she could have an abortion, the government must immediately allow her to proceed to the facility and have the procedure. Judge Kavanaugh dissented, and there were a couple of points about that dissent that were very striking. The first was, right, remember this is a guy who before the hearings was quoted as saying, well, Roe versus Wade is settled law. But when you look at what he wrote in that opinion, he never said that. He said existing Supreme Court precedent, never even naming the case. But he says we are assuming that existing Supreme Court precedent guarantees a right to choose abortion. It was extraordinary language. And then he went on to say, I see no harm in letting the government delay this for 11 days. But he didn't even say at the end of 11 days she can have the abortion. He said at the end of 11 days they may have some other arguments that they want us to hear. So, you know, in a weird way, there was a lot of questioning of him about this email that he had sent in the White House where he said, I'm not sure all scholars would describe Roe versus Wade as the settled law of the land. But that to me was a kind of a waste of time. There's no secret. He's written what he thinks about Roe versus Wade.
What is settled law? What does that phrase mean?
Well, I'm so glad you asked me that question, because I got interested in it after that quote, and I began poking around in the cases and in the legal dictionaries, encyclopedias. It's really a term that doesn't have a whole lot of meaning. Justice Roberts once used the term super precedent for certain kinds of things, like Brown versus Board of Education. And that term has no meaning either, right? But I did find a really excellent definition in the U.S. reports from Justice Stevens saying, this court rarely grants certiorari to reverse settled law. And I think that provides you a kind of workman's definition of it. That is, settled law is anything the court doesn't want to overturn.
Exactly.
Right. So it has no, there is no legal barrier to reversal from the description of something as settled.
What troubles me and many people the most, I think, is the whole question of how this judge has been vetted and the number of documents withheld. You write in one of your articles that vetting is a constitutional requirement. Spell that out.
Article 2 of the Constitution says the president shall nominate, comma, and with the advice and consent of the Senate shall appoint justices of the Supreme Court. And so the Constitution mandates a role for the Senate in approving or disapproving nominees to a federal judgeship. That's not optional. In other words, the president can't really name someone and say, look, guys, let's just skip the whole thing. The Senate has a responsibility, if it's going to proceed with a nomination, to do its job.
Are you suggesting that this hearing, because of the lack of documentation, is unconstitutional?
I would say that it comes very close to violating the settled understandings of the Constitution. We are hearing, this hearing is being held now purely for political, purely for partisan reasons. No one pretends otherwise. The Republicans want this nomination put in place before the fall elections, first because they think it will rally the base, and secondly, because there is some concern they will lose control of the Senate, at which point the nomination would probably be dead. So they're saying we have to do it now. We will not delay. Minority members of the committee have asked for a delay. They've asked for adjournment. And they're also saying there isn't time to get you the documents you want. Well, my response to that is, look, the committee is supposed to do a good job. If this nominee, if his files are so numerous and so sensitive that they can't be made available, this isn't like the dog ate my homework. You're supposed to provide the Senate with a nominee it can confirm. And if you can't, if the nominee you have picked is one who can't be adequately vetted, then withdraw the nomination and pick one who can, because there are plenty of qualified people who are on the president's list who wouldn't have this problem, who wouldn't have masses of documents, many of which are supposedly covered by executive privilege. He could have named one of those.
Tell me your thoughts on his exchange with Kamala Harris, on whether he had interaction with Trump's lawyer's law firm on the Mueller investigation.
Well, you know, I think there have been a couple of moments in these hearings where we've seen genuine uneasiness on the face of the nominee.
His whole demeanor changed.
And, of course, you know, it is a classic witness situation where the witness doesn't know what the questioner knows. There's been a real attempt to control what information can be made available to the Democrats who can question him. But on a couple of occasions, once when Senator Leahy questioned him about the stolen emails in the Bush administration, and this time where he clearly thought there's something out there and I don't know what she's going to hit me with. And, you know, his response was, well, I don't know all the people that work on this this firm.
Yeah, who are you talking about? Give
right,
me a
give
name.
Give me the name so that I can deny that. And I think the idea that he is unaware of who the important people in this law firm are, particularly for former Senator Lieberman and so forth, that doesn't hold water. So I don't know how significant these conversations were. He has now stated that he didn't confer with anyone on the confirmation team about the release of documents. He said that's been done by the White House. If that's not so, it's troubling that he would say that it is so.
At what point do you think Kamala Harris could release what it is she has that brought her to ask those questions?
I don't know what Senator Harris has, whether she just has personal knowledge or an affidavit, or she might have a witness she could call. If it's a committee confidential document, I think one thing we have now seen as a result of what went on yesterday is, if you got a committee confidential document and you think the document is incredibly germane to the fitness of the nominee, then go ahead and release it and say to them, the way Senator Booker did yesterday, you want to come at me? Bring it, right? Bring it. Come after me. Try to expel, you know, one of the few women of color from the Senate because she breaks this invented rule. There's never been this rule before. And I don't think she would have much to fear from that. So I don't know what's in her mind, and I don't know whether there's any strategy behind it. But it was a very surreal moment. You're absolutely right.
I must say, I think that these documents that Republicans dumped on Democrats at the 12th hour or 11:59, it was ridiculous.
Well, it's all part of what I was talking about earlier, which is that the insistence that this nomination has to be approved now, no matter what damage it does to the rules and the traditions of the Senate. And this entire manipulation of the document process is brand new. It's not something that was done with other nominees. This manipulation of committee confidentiality is, to my knowledge, brand new. And the use of threats, and to have Senator Cornyn standing up and saying that senators who, you know, defy the committee chair are liable to be expelled from the Senate, that's quite extraordinary, too. And interestingly enough, Cornyn himself began talking about the McCarthy era. And when he did, I thought, you know, if I were you, Senator, I wouldn't go there, because the closest thing I have seen in a long time to McCarthyism was his threats to Senator Booker that he would have him expelled from the Senate for defying Chairman Grassley.
If Judge Kavanaugh had been nominated under George Bush, say, would the hearings have been this contentious? Would he have been considered such a radical nominee?
Well, I think there are three parts of that. And I think the first thing to understand is that Kavanaugh really is extraordinarily conservative, even within the spectrum of conservative judges. He is someone who's given every evidence of fairly lockstep allegiance to, you know, the agenda of the conservative legal movement, whether it's in the area of executive power, affirmative action. But, you know, Kavanaugh is a very smooth, well-trained, well-spoken, intelligent person who has not made any kind of obvious mistakes, but he's extremely conservative. But the second part of it is that would make this nomination contentious under any circumstances is what we've been talking about, this remarkable long, you know, decades-long involvement with the executive branch and this devotion of his career to the service of executive power. Kavanaugh has kept coming back during the hearings, like, I am an independent judge. The judiciary is independent. But his resume does not suggest independence. Contrast it with Anthony Kennedy, whom he's replacing, right? Kennedy had an extraordinary record. He had been a small town solo practitioner running an office in Sacramento, California, on his own, beholden to no one, who, as a favor, really, worked with Governor Ronald Reagan independently from outside the administration to help him with some tax measures, and in return was named to the bench by President Ford as a gesture of friendship to President Reagan. He never was a servant of any politician. He never worked for any politician. He never was an employee of the executive branch. He was independent. And, you know, love him or hate him, you knew that he made up his own mind. I don't see anything like that in Kavanaugh's resume.
What is your thinking about these hearings taking place in the midst of the writing of an anonymous op-ed, which talks about people close to the president having considered imposing the 25th Amendment early on.
Well, I think the whole week has been so surreal in terms of the backdrop. Because if you remember, now think all the way back to Monday, right? And in the times we're living in now, that's a long time. On Monday, we awoke to the president issuing, basically seeming to issue instructions to the Attorney General that the Department of Justice was to deploy its resources in order to ensure that Republicans were reelected to the House and that prosecutions of Republicans should cease at once. Now, that's surreal enough, right? That's Monday. Okay. But then we have the hearings convened and the chairman saying, you know, we're not giving you the documents. You're not allowed to move to adjourn. We don't want to, you know, you're out of order. You can't ask me questions. We are jamming this nomination through and we don't care what you say or anyone else. And that's surreal in itself. Then we have Woodward. Right. We have this amazing book, even for Woodward, producing details of what's going on inside the White House. We have the stories of, you know, senior executive officials stealing papers from the president's desk because they think the president doesn't have the capacity to understand what they will do. And if he signs them, they'll be damaging, comparing each other to rats and snakes and so forth. So then you're like, oh, we're there, you know. No, then we have the op-ed, right? Then we have like, I am a senior government official, you know, speaking out of the dark, and the president is, it's all worse than you think.
Another deep throat.
Yeah. Well, he is and he isn't, or she is and she isn't, because deep throat provided information, right? What the op-ed does is say, don't worry, good people like me will save you. There wasn't anything in the op-ed that wasn't already out there in the Woodward book, except I exist, right? So that, as people say, this is not the same as whistleblowing. This is kind of virtue signaling by an anonymous person.
How worried are you about our country?
I've never been, you know, and I've followed constitutional matters for a long time as a journalist and then as a scholar. You know, and you and I both lived through 68. We lived through the Vietnam War. I've never been so worried about the future of this country. I've never been so worried about what's going to happen to our children and grandchildren. The country's on a knife edge, and I don't know which way it's going to fall, and neither does anyone else. And the people who have the responsibility for making sure things don't collapse are deliberately hiding. So, you know, is this person in the New York Times, are they the adult in the room? I don't know. They say they are. But the adults who are supposed to be in the room, whose names we know, are under the table. They're terrified of this man. How did that happen?
Garrett Epps, thank you so much.
Enjoyed it.
That was Garrett Epps, constitutional law professor at the University of Baltimore and a contributing editor at The Atlantic. Now a quick break. When I come back, my conversation with Norm Ornstein.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Now, here's Norm Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute. I spoke with him on Thursday afternoon about the anonymous op-ed in the New York Times. In it, someone claiming to be a senior administration official wrote that members of the president's staff are working behind the scenes to thwart part of his agenda. Norm Ornstein, it's been 24 hours since we read the online version of the New York Times op-ed. What did you make of it?
Well, to some degree, I was gobsmacked by this. None of us expected something like this. It completely took over, certainly the Washington political community. I suspect it happened around the country. And it was more because it confirmed in a direct way what we had heard for the past 17 months, one way or another, mostly through leaks done to reporters or in books that have been published about the fact that large numbers of people inside the White House saw their role as protecting the country from the president rather than working for the president to make things happen. And this was a direct confirmation of that.
And coming on the heels of the Bob Woodward book.
I, of course, have not read the book. It's not yet been published. A few reporters have. We've seen some of the things that are in that book that confirm pretty much what was in the book Fire and Fury and in what we've seen from the book by Omarosa. But it's different when it comes from Bob Woodward. When he was doing a book on the Clinton White House, I got a call one afternoon in my office from Bob Woodward. And what he said was he was doing fact-checking on a footnote that included a memo that had mentioned my name. And it was a minor thing, but I hung up the phone and I said to myself, oh my God, I've never had an experience like this.
He is thorough, if nothing else.
Woodward is in a class by himself, and there's little doubt that he has records, including tapes of many of these interviews, and little doubt that many of the people who have said indignantly that they didn't say the things that they are reputed to have said were actually not being candid.
Norm, Washington has been playing a guessing game as to who wrote that New York Times editorial. I wonder whether it could have been an amalgam of several people meant to disguise a particular writing style.
That was my first inclination, Diane, that when you read that piece by Anonymous, the way it's worded, the way it's crafted, it seems to have been done by either a professional writer or an op-ed editor or somebody who's very much familiar with the style and framing of pieces like this. And it wouldn't have surprised me at all, given what we know about the Woodward book and others, given that we know that there are large numbers of people in the administration who have seen firsthand the erratic, sometimes irresponsible, explosive behavior by a president in what Kelly has, according to Maggie Haberman of the New York Times, who really knows her stuff, told many people is crazy land in the White House, that a number of them would have gotten together in the aftermath of the Woodward book and said, we want to get this out publicly and not simply get it into a war of words where the president will say it's all fiction, but the best way to do it is to have a collective effort that comes out as a single person.
So do you think that's what happened?
Look, let's be honest, Diane. We
have
no clue.
And absolutely.
The Times said that it was a senior official. What is a senior official? It could be a deputy assistant or a deputy assistant secretary. Those we would not normally view as senior officials.
Exactly.
So it could be a cabinet member or a top sub-cabinet member. It could be a White House staff person, including the chief of staff. It could be any of a number of people. I accept the word of the op-ed editor of the New York Times that this is indeed a sitting senior official in the administration.
So isn't all this likely to make President Trump even more defiant?
Yes. Well, we already know it.
Irrational as he looks around at his staff. He has no idea whom to trust. He has no idea to whom he can turn and that his actions won't be reported.
We know from additional leaks from inside that his response to this op-ed was, to use a polite term, explosive. He was already over the edge about the Woodward book. And of course, we know how Trump responds to things. We've had the release of the tape of the conversation he did with Bob Woodward, where he flattered Bob Woodward, "You've always been fair," and all of this, and was told to expect a negative book. And we knew his response to it would be, "You can't trust Bob Woodward. You've never been able to trust Bob Woodward. This is all fiction." But we also know that he had already begun the process of seeking out within his White House who might be the people who talked to Woodward, who the leakers are. We even now see, I just noticed, that quote-unquote libertarian Rand Paul in the Senate has said, apply lie detector test to everybody, which is not what you would normally see a libertarian saying. This is clearly from the commentary of people inside, close to the president, a president who can't be trusted, who's out of control.
Do you think the Times should have published an anonymous piece this powerful?
So my take on this is the Times should have published the piece, but I'm not sure that the person or people who wrote it should have done it this way. David Frum wrote a very powerful piece in The Atlantic after this came out saying, this is cowardice. There are ways to handle this. And the way to handle it is if you really do believe, even if it's the case that this administration has done some things you're proud of and happy with, that we have a president who needs to be restrained on a daily basis, who needs to have documents stolen from his desk to keep him from taking actions that are illegal, impulsive, and dangerous, then your obligation is to identify yourself publicly, resign, and testify in front of Congress about what's going on. This op-ed, remember, Diane, said we thought about using the 25th Amendment. Birch Bayh, who wrote it, and the staff who helped put it together were very careful in trying to design features to deal with presidential disability. Mostly it was about a heart attack, a stroke, or things of that sort. But there are also provisions if a president is incapable of performing the duties because the president is mentally incapacitated or dangerous in other ways. Now, this anonymous op-ed said, we thought about it, which itself
early,
which itself is frightening, but it would provoke a constitutional crisis. What could provoke a constitutional crisis more than a senior official in the administration writing an anonymous op-ed saying we thought about invoking the 25th Amendment? Because he's a lunatic.
Are we in a constitutional crisis?
You know, you can define constitutional crises in different ways. Everything that we have learned would suggest that we are in an existential crisis for not just the Constitution, but our way of life. And we can reflect on this more broadly because this isn't just about a president whose own staff believes that he can't be trusted and is out of control, that has to regularly block him from doing things that are illegal and or dangerous. But it's also that the framers anticipated that we could have a president who had no moral standards, who would be a demagogue, who could lead us to autocracy or authoritarian government, and they built in safeguards, and the number one safeguard is an independent Congress providing a check and balance. The constitutional crisis that we have starts in the first branch with a majority that still has not held a hearing on any of these explosive allegations coming from inside and reported outside, that has not dealt with the corruption in the White House and in the cabinet, the kleptocracy of manipulating for personal gain, and on the failures in governance. We would not be having the same kind of constitutional crisis if Congress had done its job.
I find myself wondering what role John McCain's funeral played in all of this, followed by the release of some of the quotes in Bob Woodward's book, followed by the confirmation hearings of Judge Kavanaugh And now comes this New York Times editorial.
You know, I watched the variety of ceremonies surrounding John McCain very closely, and it was striking. I happen to have known McCain pretty well, and I worked with him very closely on campaign finance reform. But what's striking is, you know, I've seen a couple of ceremonies for public figures who weren't presidents who died. Ted Kennedy had one. And Ted Kennedy was a giant of the Senate. Clearly, any ranking by historians of the most significant senators of the 20th century would put him at or near the top. And John McCain was an extraordinary figure. But this went beyond Kennedy. It went beyond Bobby Kennedy. It went beyond even some presidents. And the reason is not just because of who McCain was, but what he represented at this time,
exactly,
where everything is falling apart. But having said that, and seeing the intense coverage, and watching congressional leaders when he was in state in the Capitol, who talked about how wonderful McCain was, but have done everything the opposite of what McCain wanted. And then now, watching his dear friend, Lindsey Graham, days after the funeral, basically saying about Trump, a man who during the campaign and even afterwards he said was a lunatic, effectively, now saying anybody who says that there's any truth to this stuff is wrong, it makes you realize that this was a brief moment in time for McCain, and now people have reverted back to form, and that form now is relentless tribalism and, as I said earlier, a Republican majority in Congress that, as long as it can get Kavanaugh, having gotten Gorsuch, having now gotten through a sixth almost of all the appeals court judges in the United States, many of them slots left open because they blocked Obama nominees, having gotten Gorsuch because of the unprecedented denial of Merrick Garland, that they'll accept almost anything from Trump. And it's one thing to simply accept the fact that he's enriching himself while president and his family's enriching himself. It's another if he's ready to abrogate treaties, go to war, or do things that could endanger the very fabric of this society. I can't understand it or abide by it.
Do you believe that that New York Times op-ed changed any minds?
I actually think that the Times may not be read much out in the heartland, but the Times has always been the paper of record. It is the opinion leader. When it does something like this, it reverberates. It is discussed around the country. And it has to make at least some of the people who supported him, even knowing he was not what they had hoped in his personal life or style, and even though he had not given them what he had promised them, at least in economic terms, but accepted the fact that he was, you know, throwing things around to upset the swamp and the status quo, they've got to start to think now that this is a much deeper problem. And it's going to take that and a change in attitudes. Republican partisans in the country support Trump overwhelmingly. And that explains a significant portion of why all these Republicans in Congress do. If they start to turn on him, if public opinion in that sector begins to move a little bit, then we might see some action.
On the other hand, you still have Trump claiming his poll numbers are way up when that's not true. It's a lie.
Well, we know now, actually, the number of lies. You know, Glenn Kessler, who does the fact checker column for The Washington Post, and who drove the Obama forces crazy and Hillary Clinton crazy because he really does look
He's
carefully
so good.
At stuff.
Yeah.
You know, has done repeated efforts that show that, you know, Trump lies multiple times every day. But the fact that he said his poll numbers were greater than Abraham Lincoln's when there were no polls back then, that he took a poll number that was disapproval of him and converted it in his tweet to approval of him. You know, it just makes you throw up your hands. But if that were his only sin, you know, we would cringe, but we could tolerate it. When he's ready to blow up NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, and other treaties unlawfully, when he shreds his papers and the staff has to scotch tape them together again because he's violating the Presidential Records Act, when he goes out and basically says some neo-Nazis are very fine people, that's different from simply lying.
Norm Ornstein, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure, Diane, always.
And that's all for this week. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Send us an email, theartpodcast@wamu.org, or leave us a voicemail. The number is 202-854-8851, and go to our website, dianereem.org. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harden, comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman, Allison Brody, and Sandra Baker. Our engineers this week are Ben Privett, Natalie Yurev-Lipker, and Douglas Bell. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.